It's funny because at almost any other church, you go and the kids are always occupying the back row, right? That's pretty... You'd have to agree with me on that. And sure enough, we get to the feast and the kids on the back row. And I mentioned kids should be on the front row. And bang, they appeared. It was great. So I like you guys up there. It makes me feel younger. Yeah, well, they're kids to me. I'm a kid to you. Yes, it's all relative. Yeah, I just want to read you this poem because it kind of ties into my sermon a little bit today. It says, "Bless our own Father that we cherish the bread before there is none. Discover each other before we leave and enjoy each other for what we are while we have time." It was written by Richard Wong. Very nice prayer because you should really appreciate what you have while you have it. Today I'm going to read out of two main verses, chapters, Matthew 18 and Luke 15. So I'm going to start Matthew 18. If you have two tags in your Bible, you might want to put them there because we'll be going back and forth to those. Too often we take things for granted or we lose something of great value before we even realize how valuable it is to us. And today I want to talk about something of great value to our Father. So I'm going to start in Matthew 18. I'm going to start in verse 11. It says, "For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. How think you, if a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go into the mountains and seek that which is gone astray? If so be that he find it, verily I say unto you, he rejoices more of that sheep than of the 99 which went not astray." And the interesting thing here is that these three verses, 11, 12, and 13, are bookend about children. They're talking, verses of that are talking about children. It says in verse 10, "Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." I really like that verse because basically I see the implication there that we have guardian angels, right? And that's where I think people get that from that verse right there. And that's comforting to know that you have a guardian angel, right? Something that God, someone that God has put in charge of looking after you a little bit. And verse 14, if you go to the other bookend, it says, "Even so, it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." Now, when we say children, Harry, it's not specifically talking about children, though, is it? Because someone who's little in the faith is still described as a child, right? A child, so someone who's little in the faith. So the word obviously has more than one meaning. If I change now to go to Luke 15, we're going to see the sister verses to that same thing I just read. Luke chapter 15 and verse 1, it says, "Then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them." Now Jesus knew what they were saying. Now if they were murmuring, how did he know that? It's kind of like that show, The Mentalist. I like that show. He used to be a scam artist, and the people thought he was psychic because he would read people. He knew how to read people and knew how to scam them through, by reading them. And Jesus Christ was also very familiar with the reads people give off. And verse 3 goes on, he says, "And he spake this parable unto them, saying, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. I say unto you that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repents more than 99 just persons which need no repentance." And it's interesting, the word that we use for pastor nowadays, you can find this, the word pastor used in Jeremiah 3:15. I'm not going to turn there. But it's taken from the Latin, and it actually means shepherd, someone who looks after a flock. But I'm going to talk about an incident that happened last year. And then when I'm done, I've got to ask you how many people actually watched this with me. But there was a 121-year-old mine in Chile that collapsed last year, right? It was in the Atacama Desert, one of the harshest, driest places in the world. This mine is so old. If you think of a mine nowadays, they sink a shaft. They have arms that come off the shaft, and they do the mining in those arms, right? This mine was so old, they ran a spiral down, big spiral, many, many spirals, till they were way, way underground. These men were 2,300 feet underground, and it collapsed just above them. So now, and Judy and I went for a really interesting tour through a mine way up in Churchill Falls. It's interesting because when you get way underground, they put in safety rooms. So these rooms are super reinforced, and if there's a collapse or something, everyone scatters, if they get a chance, into these rooms. So what this happened, this collapse happened on August the 5th last year, August the 5th. By the 22nd, they were still drilling. Do you think any of their families thought these guys were still alive 17 days later? I'm sure they'd all given up hope, right? These men are lost. It's 33 of them gone. But on the 22nd, a drill bit came through just outside their safety room. And of course, when they're drilling, this is really, really hard rock. When they're drilling through it, they could hear it coming 3 days before it ever got to them. So, being good soldiers of red-green, they got their duct tape out and they stuck a note to the end of the drill bit, duct taped it. They pulled the drill bit back out and they looked at it. And there's a note from they called themselves the 33. So that's what they were called forever after until they were rescued. But they were 2,300 feet underground. If by ramp, they were 3 miles underground. So even after they got that note, how many think their families thought they were... At first, they'd say, oh, they're alive. But now they're buried alive, right? How do you get them out? There's no way to get them out. And it was companies coming from all over that actually sunk tubes down to get them out. Now, when they finally got those guys out, they figure over a billion people watch this event on TV. How many of you guys watch this event on TV? Yeah, we're part of that billion. A lot of us. Now, I have to say, personally, I had tears in my eyes. I was pretty happy. That was a miraculous event. That was phenomenal. And if you watch any of the actual diagrams they were showing, all those shafts had to be put in on an angle to miss the spiral, right? Because they couldn't keep going through. They could create more collapses. So they had to come in on an angle and hit the exact spiral they wanted to hit. Phenomenal engineering. Phenomenal. It was, in my mind, it was a miracle. But that same rejoicing that we all felt when you saw those guys come out, you're thinking, this is amazing. This is great. That's the same rejoicing our Father in Heaven finds when he finds the lost sheep. Now today, unfortunately, there's many things in the Bible that are a lot less relevant to us, even less, more or less relevant to our kids than it was back then. And that's why we have different translations of the Bible, right? Because we find it much more easy to comprehend what the Bible's saying when it's put in our language. But today, I have to say, sheep has very little value to me. I'm just not part of that society, you know, probably even less to our kids. But, you know, if you think about it, sheep have never been wild. As far as we go biblically, sheep have never been wild. Right from the very first, Abel kept sheep, right? He kept sheep. Adam and Eve were still in the garden when God made them coats of skin. Most likely, I would bet either sheep or goats, one of the two. Just, you know, but getting back to my comment about what a sheep means to us today, if you go for a mortgage, you have to prove to them that you can pay your mortgage back, right? So they make you fill out all this document saying, oh, what are you worth? What are you worth in the future? How much potential do you have? So you have to go through and you have to list your income and your potential income and all your assets, right? And your stocks and your bonds and all that stuff. But how did people used to measure wealth? Back then, it was all, that's right, assets, their herds. So if we all slip back now to Genesis 12, you're going to see it's all like land and sheep and cattle and camels and bulls and even servants. They were considered their assets because that was potential labor they had. Same as we have potential labor when we show our paychecks. Yes, yes. Genesis 12, verse 16. And it starts with, and he entreated Abraham well for her sake, and he had sheep, and oxen, and he asses, and men servants, and maid servants, and she asses, and camels. So basically, it was saying he was a rich man. That's what it was saying, just in different terms there. If you go a couple chapters later to chapter 26, Genesis chapter 26 and verse 12. It's another term we're going to read here. That's not really relevant today, but we'll translate it. Verse 12 says, then Isaac sowed in that land and received in the same year 100-fold. So his crops came in really good. And the Lord blessed him. And the man waxed great. We don't say that anymore, do we? We don't say, hey, that guy's waxed. We say, he is rich. Waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great. Today we say, filthy rich. I don't know where that saying came from, filthy rich, because generally they're not very dirty. But he was rich. And how do we know he was rich? Well, Verse 14, for he had possessions, and it goes into his assets again, right? Flocks and possessions of herds and great store of servants, and the Philistines envied him. Now, there's nothing wrong with being wealthy. Unfortunately, that connotation comes out sometime in church. It should never come out. But you should be a good steward with your money. You should be a good steward. Money should never be first in your life. It should never be second or third. But it's nothing wrong with being wealthy. And being poor does not make you a better person. Actually, as far as being diligent, if you want to go to Proverbs 27, here's actually a good little lesson in life. Proverbs 27 and verse 23. And it's actually talking about riches again. We'll see when we get to verse 24. But Proverbs 27 and verse 23 says, be you diligent to know the state of your flocks and look well to your herds. Because that's your livelihood. That's how you take care of things. Matter of fact, the Bible tells you in different places, you should be able to lay up. See, this is also less relevant to us today, but you should be able to lay up for your children and your children's children. So you should be able to leave inheritances for them. And I know today we're a fairly wealthy generation, right? Now, we've often said to our parents, don't you spend the money on what you need. We're so blessed. We're so lucky. God's blessed us so much that we don't have the worries you had when you were younger. So just spend what you need. But the Bible says you really should lay up for your children and your children's children. So you have to be diligent with what you have to be able to do that. And verse 24 says, for riches, that's your herds and your flocks, for riches are not forever, and does the crown endure to every generation? So they're perishable riches, but you still need to take care of them. Now, people guarded these animals very carefully because, unlike us, they were very valuable to them. The sheep fed them. The sheep clothed them. The sheep was what they used for sacrifices to God. If you go back and you look in Genesis, it talks about Isaac and Rebekah had twins, right? Esau and Jacob. Esau was a hunter. Again, back then, there was no guns. There was no scopes. There's no tree stands. No camouflage outfits, you know. It was hard work. Today, it's a sport, right? So today you read it and you say, oh, Esau was a hunter. Guy had a good time. Jacob was a farmer. And we all know farmers work hard, right? That's a hard job. So one was diligent, one wasn't. But that's not what it was saying. They just had different professions. Esau, unfortunately, married a Hittite woman. Now, it might not have been unfortunate because basically it was saying, if you marry someone outside of your religion, the odds are stacked against you. They don't have to be. Judy wasn't part of this religion when I met her. I saw great potential there, and I stuck with her, and she stuck with me, and it worked out perfect. But it made Isaac and Rebekah sad when he married a Hittite. Because of that, the odds were stacked against him. So, when they came to Jacob, they said, yeah, I don't think so. I want you to do something a little bit different. We want you to go to Paddan Aram and pick a wife from your uncle Laban, where he lived. And of course, Jacob fell in love with Rachel, his cousin. But what did he have to do first before he could marry her? He had to work as a shepherd for 7 years. 7 years. And then he took a sucker punch, didn't he? Because he didn't even get her. He got her sister. And that's a good lesson on sin. Because everyone here, except for maybe Audrey, I'm pretty sure everyone here would realize that you pretty much cannot sleep with someone and not know who they are unless you've been tipping it a little bit. Too much. Having a little bit of wine is not a sin. Having a little bit too much, that's a little bit wrong. So he paid the price for it. And then he continued to pay the price actually for the rest of his life. Now, Leah might have been a nice woman. It might have been a benefit in the long run. But he didn't get the girl he wanted. He had to work another 7 years as a shepherd to get Rachel's hand. Let's turn over to Genesis 31 and verse 38. Because basically, he's going to tell us right from his own mouth that shepherding was hard, hard work. Genesis chapter 31 and verse 38 says exactly what I've been telling you. It says, for 20 years I've been with you, caring for your flocks. In all that time, your sheep and goats never miscarried. He took pretty good care of them, eh? Every time they were due, he was there. In all those years, I never used a single ram of yours for food. If any were attacked and killed by wild animals, I never showed you the carcass and asked you to reduce the count of your flock. No, I took the loss myself. And you made me pay for every stolen animal, whether it was taken in broad daylight, the implication was you should have seen it, or in the dark night, when the guy had to sleep sooner or later, right? So, basically, how did he not reduce his flock? If the animals were killed or stolen, how did he not reduce it? I'm going to open that up to the floor, because all you guys should know this. How was he paid? Where did he get his from? Right on. That's exactly what happened back then. That was very, very common. So if he got 10% of whatever was born, he had his tenth. So he always paid the penalty out of his own tenth. So basically he was getting less and less, right? And I say tenth generously there. I worked for you through the scorching heat of the day, this is verse 40, and through cold and sleepless nights. Yes, for 20 years I slaved in your house. I worked for 14, earning your two daughters, and then six more for your flock. So he wanted to get to build up a little bit of riches. Those were his riches, so he could care for it, because now he's being diligent with his money, right? And you changed my wages 10 times. How many people think that he got kept up in his wages? Thank you. Because the implication there was, hey, this guy's doing too good. I don't want to lose him. Pump it down, down, down. But he was diligent with his money, and he ended up getting out of there. Now, Moses is another example, right? He worked as a shepherd for Jethro to pay for Jethro's daughter, Zipporah. Moses actually started the whole process off by getting in a fight with the other shepherds at the well. Remember that? So shepherds would often name their sheep. They would constantly count them to make sure they were all accounted for. They would fence them off. They probably, and I would put big bucks on this if I had to make a bet, and then hopefully God will settle this for me later, but I'm betting that they had dogs to protect their sheep back then. Then if one was missing, they would go and search for it as the sun was setting, and he would leave the flock behind and search for the one sheep, because back then it was valuable. That's the lesson. One is valuable. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. The problem with that verse is that the world is a big group, literally billions. You should take that verse and you should change it. So, for God so loved me, because it's still relevant. You're part of this world. He so loved me that he gave his only begotten son. Luke 15:14 said, what man of you having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them? One, that's the lesson. Does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost till he finds it. That's another reason I think that they had dogs. Because you don't leave 99 sheep in the wilderness. Because sheep, the saying is, they scatter like sheep, right? Scatter. And we've seen that. Well, I'll tell you a story a little later. And so I think they left them with their faithful border collie, and he just kept them, you know, in line. Matthew 12 says something quite along similar lines. And you're all familiar with this verse, Matthew 12, verse 11. What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, run again, and it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? So the one is valuable. Now we have a rule at work. Boys are familiar with this. The rescuer should never become the victim. That seems like a foolish thing to say, because when everyone's running out of a building, we're running into a building. So it sounds like we're volunteering to be the victim. But we run in because we have a fairly good idea of what's going to be safe and what's not going to be safe. And when it goes beyond what we think is safe, we get out of the building. So we basically take care of ourselves. Now, this really comes into effect. When we do ice water rescue, we make sure you have to have a life jacket on or you have to have a survival suit on. Especially ice water, right? You have to have a survival suit on, or you don't, it's all throw, right? You don't go. Now, the problem is, certain things come up, and you have to weigh your odds, right? So, I'll give you an example. Last February, we had a dog went through the ice. This is in a retention pond. Is everyone familiar with what a retention pond is? All new neighborhoods have to have retention ponds. In general, retention ponds are not that deep, right? They're just there to store storm water, and then they have an overflow level, and then the overflow goes out again. So this dog had gone through the ice. When the guys got there, all that was out was his nose and his little paws on the edge of the ice. And one of the guys, like, he saw all the rest of the guys behind him. You know, they're ready. They're getting everything ready. He just figured, well, if I go through, I'll probably still be able to stand up. So he kind of broke the rule. The rescuer should never become the victim. But he weighed his odds. He went out there, grabbed the dog, pulled it out. The people were ecstatic. But unfortunately, many times, what they'll do is they'll fall into running water, or they'll fall into a deep pond. Like in Guelph, we have the OR ponds, and there's always people out there with dogs. The dog goes through there, if you don't have something on, you're going to die if you go through with them. This just happened just before the feast in St. Fulgence, Quebec. It has a very fast river that flows through St. Fulgence. And there was a 6-year-old boy and his cousin. He was 8 years old. They dropped their toy into the river, so they both jumped in after it. Well, instantly they got sucked away. So luckily the father saw this, so they jumped in. The 8-year-old's father grabbed the kid and actually got close enough to the shore he could grab something, and he got him out. Then he turned around, and the 6-year-old's father was not winning the battle with the 6-year-old. So he jumps back in again. He's already got one rescue under his belt, so I'm sure it buoyed his confidence. They were losing the battle. So now the 6-year-old's mother jumps in the river, trying to rescue them all. Because if you all kind of form a chain, the thought process, I can see it right now, is I'll stay closer, you get the next guy, you get the next guy. The 8-year-old's mother knew the rule. She put on a life jacket. She ran downriver, jumped in, got the 6-year-old boy, got him out. The other three never made it to shore again, alive. So it's, you know, sad. But the point is, we will risk our lives for something that's very important to us. All those three parents risked their lives. They knew there was a risk. But if they knew they were absolutely going to die, they would have reweighed that again, right? If they knew they were going to die, then they couldn't save their child. What's the point of jumping in? If you're camping, this is an example I gave. If you're camping and a grizzly grabs your dog, you don't go running outside and kick it in the butt, right? You just don't do that. You wait for your chance, you run to the car, jump inside and lock the door. You know, because good chance that grizzly's going to kill you too. Now, there's another shepherd in the Bible I want to turn to, 1 Samuel chapter 17. Who actually, you got to give this guy credit. One very brave man, very sure of himself. His name was David. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 34. And David said to Saul, "Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock." Now the bears in that part of the world are not the size of Kodiaks, they're not the size of grizzlies. They're still really dangerous. Not something you would tackle. Verse 35, "And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me," he's talking about the lion now, "I caught him by his beard and smote and slew him." So I'm guessing he had either a really short sword or a really long knife and slit this animal's jugular. But he grabbed him by the beard on his chin. Now, those things have sharp claws. I can't see how he walked away without some major wounds. And verse 36, "And your servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be as one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." That is a very dedicated shepherd. Someone who understood the value of a lamb. Nathan the prophet approached David with a parable in 2 Samuel 12. 2 Samuel 12. Now we know what David's done, so we know he knows the value of a sheep. 2 Samuel 12, verse 1 says, "And the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, 'There were two men in one city, the one rich, the other poor. The rich man had many flocks," right? Many herds. That's how we know he was rich. "The poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished up." Now, I can relate to this because I can remember my dad telling me about his little goat. He had a little goat when he was a kid, and it was like a family pet. And you'll see here, it grew up together with him and with his children. It did eat of his own meat and drink out of his own cup. So, I mean, this thing was a pet. It was a family pet. "He lay it in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler to the rich man, and this greedy guy, he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd and dressed." So, in other words, he slaughtered and dressed the wayfaring man. "To dress for the wayfaring man that had come to him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against this man, and he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man that has done this thing shall surely die.'" In other words, he had no pity, right? He didn't understand the value of that sheep. David did. And that's why that situation with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, it actually hit home so much. So now, should we care any less about a lost sheep than Jesus does? When worldwide imploded, there was well over 100,000 people that scattered. Sheep scattered. A lot of us here are part of them, right? How many of us reached out to help the others? Because that's our job, right? Do we end up so angry at large groups, we only meet with little small fellowship groups, only looking at internal development, we don't have an outreach program anymore? No, we have to take care of the lost. Shepherds are sacrificial. Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. It's amazing what a shepherd will do for the sheep. Do you think you love your children any more than God loves his children? When one of your children goes astray and their life goes down the toilet, do you have a family meal and not notice that seat empty? No, of course you notice it empty. You can't just shrug it off because the rest of your kids are still there. You count your blessings, you mourn for the loss, and you're thankful for the rest that God's given you. But that one life that you're mourning for means even more to God. I'm going to turn over to Isaiah 53. These two quotes we read about in Matthew 18 and Luke 15 are actually tied into Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53, verse 6. Says, all we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one of us to his own way. And Jehovah has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Jesus tells about looking for the lost sheep, but how did it get lost? Really, it went astray. It says right here, it went astray. It wandered off. It didn't see the large woods and say, wow, I want to get lost today. That just doesn't happen. We saw this firsthand in Ireland, actually. I saw these two sheep. They snuck out through the gates. Judy is killing herself laughing at me. I didn't realize that they're fast. So I thought, oh, I'll scare them back in because we had just gone through this farmer's field. So I felt bad for the guy. He's nice enough that he lets all these people go up to this ruin up at the top of his mountain. So I thought, I'll chase. I got the one. I chased him back in. The other one was too fast. Finally, I gave up. Well, I gave up because I was being humiliated by my wife laughing. But they're fast. But they don't see the big picture. All they see is, hey, there's a guy coming at me. He's not trying to chase me back. They don't think that. They just think, get away from this guy. Get away from this guy. And they just take off. So I basically ended up making him wander farther off, right? But this is actually what they do. And I was talking to one of the farmers about this, and he said this exactly to me. All they care about is the next bite of grass and avoiding Doug. That's all they care about. So they're sitting there, and it's like the movie Doug, Up, with Doug the dog. Remember Doug the dog? And he goes, squirrel. That's the sheep. They're eating, and they say, grass. And they go, oh, that's so much. And then they look out. Oh, outside the fence, there's no dog. Better grass. And they weasel. And this one farmer's telling me they'll try and get out so bad, they'll get caught in the briars. And it's like Velcro. They're done. And if he doesn't come along, he finds them dead. It's kind of sad. They're dead upright, stuck in the briars. Because all they can think about is that next piece of grass. And they nibble themselves. They get out, they nibble themselves until they're gone. They're lost. And we see that exact same thing happening today in society, displayed exactly the same. It's so obvious to people watching it, but it's not to them. No one wakes up one day and says, you know what I want to be? Grade 9, right? They're always saying, what do you want to be? What do you want to be? Grade 10, what do you want to be? What do you want to be? You don't know. So you're never going to wake up one day and say, hey, I want to be a wino in the gutter. I want my own cardboard box and my own wheels with everything I own inside it. Nice silver cage. Some people call it a grocery cart. You know, that's what I want. No one says that, right? It happens little bit by little bit. No one wakes up and says, I want to be a junkie. I'll tell you, the first time I went to the meth clinic was enough for me. I never wanted to go. Now, we have to go there the odd time because people have trouble. But you never want to go there. When you see the people have clawed the skin off their bodies, whose teeth are all falling out and everything, they're, you know, 28. They look at least my age, if not older. I mean, they should be right in their prime. They should be having the fullness of life right then, and they're destroyed. But it's not like they said, hey, I want to be a meth addict. No, it's just, oh, I just want this little high and a little bit more and a little bit more. And it's exactly like the sheep. They go astray. And this bit by bit hits us in the church too, doesn't it? Because no one wakes up on the church.